Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Boria Sachs. He's a lecturer in literature in the graduate program of Mercy College, as well as at Sing Sing and Taconic Prisons. And we're talking about his latest book, Dinomania, Why We Love, Fear, and Are Utterly Enchanted by Dinosaurs. Boria, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Are you one of those people like I was who were utterly enchanted by dinosaurs when they were a kid?
Oh, yes. I was absolutely fascinated with them.
Now, you're right. Is there something innate about children's attraction to dinosaurs? Because it's amazing how many children find dinosaurs, like, fascinating. And most of it drops off after a certain age. But do you feel like it's an innate attraction?
Well, it's very hard to say. I think we haven't always been aware of dinosaurs as such, but I think children are always fascinated by large animals. Before dinosaurs, there were dragons, and
it always seems like there's some big, weird, monstrous thing that either children or cultures of the past have been fascinated by, and that's what this book is about.
Absolutely.
Now, one of the things I found fascinating is, and this book covers a lot of ground, people must have found fossils before the discovery of what we call deep time, and we'll talk about that in a bit. So let's talk about ancient cultures. What did they think these big bones were of that they were finding in the ground that were fossilized, that were turned into stone?
Well, they thought a lot of things. Many cultures, from Plains Indians to ancient Europeans, thought of them as something a bit like dinosaurs, as representing enormous creatures that had preceded human beings in the world. The most common understanding of them was as the bones of giants. Dinosaur bones, apart from their scale, look surprisingly like bones of human beings and other mammals. So it's not very hard to see why they thought that. And belief in giants seems to be just about universal, right, and may very well go back to the discovery of such bones. I think that a lot of the time people didn't write about those bones or even remark about them a great deal because they more or less took them for granted. Bones as such were an everyday part of the environment. They would see bones that had been picked bare by predators, and those were particularly big, but in many respects, they might not have seemed so different, and since they were at least very open to belief in dragons and giants and other monsters, they may not have regarded them as so extraordinary.
You mean that the belief was, well, of course there were giants, and here's their remains.
Exactly.
They also thought that there were some people wrote about them as they were the mythical titans, which were kind of giant, but they were sort of a mythological being of titans. And as we get into more sort of early Christian things, people thought that they were pre-diluvian humans.
Yes. One of the things I suggested in the book is that the image of Saint Christopher
may go back
to the bones of dinosaurs or early mammals. He is known above all for carrying the Christ child across a river during a tempest and thereby bearing the weight of the world. He is often depicted as a giant and sometimes as a giant with the head of an animal. Usually a dog or some other canid. That is partly because the saint was conflated with Hermanibus, who was in turn a conflation of the Greco-Roman Hermes with the Egyptian Anubis. The idea of this huge man with a bestial face could have been suggested by the dinosaur bones that were washed up during the storms from riverbanks that are associated with him.
Now, what about the? Let's talk about Let's talk about the discovery of deep time, and you have to explain what that term means.
Well, deep time means very remote reaches of time. Time before the advent of human beings, the time in which dinosaurs and such creatures existed. Modern period, from the 1600s on, it was generally believed in Europe that the world was only about 6,000 or so years old. However, people thought about time in a very different way than we do today. We tend to think of time in much more abstract terms, in terms of years and hours and so on, which can be measured. I think the way they imagined time was much more sensual, and saying that the world was only 6,000 or so years old meant that beyond that point, it was impossible to visualize it anymore. There were just nothing more than vague images, and perhaps not even that. And it was not exactly that time in our sense did not exist, but one just could not even begin to imagine the events that might have taken place there.
Well, about what time period would you say that that people started to conceive of a deep time, a time tremendously older than we had thought the Earth was? What years were that? What centuries?
It was largely in the 17th century, in Shakespeare, particularly in his sonnets. There are some intimations of geological time when he speaks of the kingdom of the ocean and that of the shore and the constant change of state. In Milton, we have, in Paradise Lost, an epic poem that is set in deep time. The action takes place before human beings were created. And I think that was extremely influential in preparing people for the idea of dinosaurs.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Boria Sachs, lecturer in literature in the graduate program of Mercy College, as well as at Sing Sing and Taconic Prisons. And we're talking about his latest book, which really, what I love about it is it covers a lot of grounds and a lot of different things. Dinomania, Why We Love, Fear, and Are Utterly Enchanted by Dinosaurs. Boria, when I got to your section about Milton's Paradise Lost, I thought that was very original, thinking that this romantic poet creates this vision before humanity, and it sort of sets things in motion for people to begin to imagine a world before we existed. But not only that, you write that the Milton's Paradise Lost and other romantic images, and especially the romantic ideal of the sublime, actually had an effect on how people painted and drew the first landscapes around dinosaurs.
Oh, absolutely. The aesthetic of the sublime in Milton and in Edmund Burke and in many romantic novelists such as Emily Bronte and Sir Walter Scott and Mary Shelley was centered around these very harsh, mountainous, forbidding landscapes, rocky outcrops, and these were largely the sort of landscapes that interested paleontologists. I think Milton was very important in that respect because he inspired a lot of illustrators from John Martin to William Blake,
yep,
who and Gustave Doré, who would depict landscapes that were just almost unimaginably vast in their extent, with huge horizons and that seem to seem to be appropriate to a very primeval sort of existence, the sort of landscapes where you could easily imagine primordial creatures.
What's fascinating, because I never thought about that connection before, but when I looked at some of the reproductions in your book of these early paintings of how people imagined dinosaurs, if you took the dinosaurs out, you could just stick demons in there and it would look like hell.
Yes, absolutely. And remember, there is that passage in Milton's Paradise Lost. Satan has just tempted Eve in the guise of a serpent,
yep,
and then returned home to tell all of the hosts of hell about his accomplishments. And he expects applause, but he hears hissing instead, because God has turned him and all of the demons into serpents. In other words, as soon as human history begins, the devils turn into dinosaurs.
Before we proceed on, I think a lot of people don't understand what the real meaning of sublime is. I think people use a completely different connotation for the word sublime versus the Romantic era. The Romantic era, it was not a pleasant thing. The sublime was a frightening, sort of overwhelming, like landscape, and that would give that feeling of feeling very small and powerless in the face of nature, right?
Absolutely right, but at the same time, while it was not exactly pleasant, the idea of the sublime had a lot of religious resonance, because this same feeling of smallness is what people were expected to feel in relation to God.
Right. Now let's zip ahead. And again, for people who are listening, we can't do this book justice in a half hour, so we're skipping around a bit and just talking about some of the things I was interested. So people start to realize that these bones that they're finding belong to creatures that no longer live. And you talk about the first named dinosaurs, and it sets up this archetypical pair where there's like a meat eater and a vegetarian who are always at odds. And you see that sort of juxtaposition like right through into the 20th century when people paint dinosaurs. There's always the Tyrannosaurus Rex versus the Triceratops, or the Megalosaurus versus the Iguanodon in the earliest days. And that's really fascinating. And it has a lot of meaning beyond. As you talk about, it's sort of savagery versus civilization. And it goes into ichthyosaurs and plesiosaurs. Talk about megalosaurs. Who discovered and named the first dinosaur?
Well, the first dinosaur bone that has been definitely identified was found by Robert Plott in the 1600s. The bone itself is lost, but he had a very careful illustration made from it, and subsequent paleontologists have identified it as a Megalosaurus bone. From his account, there seem to have been quite a few such bones that were known around that period, and many of them had been placed in churches or public squares, but the first first identification and naming of the Megalosaurus was in 1924 by the paleontologist William Buckland.
Now, dinosaurs, as they were pictured both in sculpture and in paintings, have had a tremendous influence on the way that the general public imagines dinosaurs. And I want to talk about a fascinating group of sculptures that you write about in the book. The sculptures for the Crystal Palace, talk about those.
Well, they were done in around 1856 for the Crystal Palace, which was this grand world's fair of spectacular dimensions, where wares from around the world were put on display in London, England. The Crystal Palace itself was like some of our skyscrapers today, made entirely of glass. And it was made on the model of a cathedral, perhaps reflecting the way that the commercial society of that time and our own had acquired all sorts of religious overtones. Now, not within the Crystal Palace, but on the edges, were representations of dinosaurs and other prehistoric creatures, which I think were a lot like the gargoyles on the fringes of the old cathedrals. The Crystal Palace Park was, again, a celebration of modernity, and the dinosaurs and other creatures were intended to show how far we'd come. The Crystal Palace itself, with all of its spectacular wares for sale, was supposed to be the epitome of civilization and modernity. The dinosaurs represented the savagery that preceded it, and that at times seemed to threaten human accomplishment. but they were so spectacular that they have lasted much longer than the Crystal Palace itself, which was burned down in the early 1930s, and they may still be seen today.
And it's amazing when you look at them, as you write about in the book, because we're so used to other representations of dinosaurs, they don't have the same effect that they did back then on modern viewers.
Well, if you look at a lot of the cartoons from the 19th century that show dinosaurs, they suggest that people were pretty afraid of them.
Yeah, yeah.
Even the models of them. And that in addition to this fear, there was a sort of consternation. They were scary. They were magnificent. But people just didn't quite know how to place them or what to think of them.
So they were still the embodiment of the sublime.
They were still the embodiment of the sublime. And because they were extinct, they were also a reminder that maybe even we human beings, for all our vaunted accomplishments, might eventually become extinct ourselves.
Whoops.
Now, the sublime was frightening, and it was supposed to be frightening, but it was only to a certain extent. It was, you know, a little bit like, you know, the thrill that we might get today from watching monster movies. But the idea of human extinction was pretty terrifying. And people didn't really have any idea of how to confront it. It just seemed at once terrifying but also crazy and unimaginable. And you sense some of this consternation in a lot of early illustrations of dinosaurs.
Well, it would seem that the idea of contemplating our own extinction would also rock a lot of religious boats, that Western religion, has always thought about humanity as being the crown of creation. And to have these things around to remind you of us that we too could become extinct is like saying... It was like saying the sun was at the center of the universe instead of the earth at the center of the universe. It seems to have had that kind of effect.
Oh, absolutely. It's, it was, among other things, a challenge to anthropocentrism.
Yeah, yeah.
And we have to remember that in many ways, the confidence in progress at about that time was at its height. People were so dazzled by human accomplishments, by factories, by steamboats, by railroads. And
here were these dinosaurs reminding us that maybe this may not progress ad infinitum.
Right, and especially because, you know, just as we are powerful in our way,
they were powerful in theirs.
Dinosaurs were powerful in theirs.
Oh, wow.
And so all of this human might didn't necessarily give a guarantee that we would survive.
Well, Bori, we're completely out of time, and we've barely scratched the surface of this complex and fun book. My guest tonight is Boria Sachs. He's a lecturer in literature in the graduate program of Mercy College, as well as at Sing Sing and Taconic Prisons. And we're talking about his latest book. It's really a beautiful book, too. Dinomania, Why We Love, Fear, and Are Utterly Enchanted by Dinosaurs. Boria, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.